So again, I'm gonna first come in from a Dharma perspective a little bit. And today I am talking, introducing some ideas from the Mahayana Buddhist perspective. Yeah, so teachings and practice approaches that come from what is sometimes called the second turning of the Dharma wheel. So after the teachings of the historical Buddha, different thinkers, practitioners kind of expanded, explored, went in different directions. And one of the kind of fundamental aspects of the second turning are teachings around emptiness practice, as kind of defined in this Mahayana way. And I'm gonna like I think I did this last week. I'll do it again. I'm gonna say like this is not like start to finish linear Dharma. I'm not trying to do that, and I can't do that here. And it's more that I'm offering things that I hope are kind of connection points or touchstones for you between creative process and your own Dharma practice. So again, I think my teacher's book on emptiness practice is great. Rob Berbea's book, Seeing That Freeze. I'll teach a course in, I think, in January with another teacher about emptiness practice, insight practice, where it's very fleshed out. This isn't going to happen today, so I apologize. It's a little from the hip. So to come back to what I'm saying, I just define a little bit around what emptiness is in this context, how one defines it, and how it supports this movement towards more freedom in the life. So last week, looking really at the Theravadin practices as a way to get some understanding of how conditioning can build up what then shows up for us as creative blocks. Yeah. So this process of accumulation and being burdened by different ideas and other people's stuff, and the kind of narrowing that can come from that. Yeah. In the Theravadin perspective that I spoke of yesterday, again, this is very like sketchy, but it has that transcendent kind of movement. Yeah. The freedom opens in a movement beyond worldly things. Yeah, that's oh, gross oversimplification. But there's that kind of directionality to it. If you are familiar with the kind of different like degrees of awakening, levels of awakening that come in the Theravadin teaching, the final one is something called an arahat. Yeah. So, and an arahat is someone who has kind of moved beyond worldly attachment so fully that they will not be reborn again in this world. If you're cool with a kind of with the idea of reincarnation, that's how that's kind of articulated and showed up. That's a real freedom. It's just that you won't be reborn again into this world. In the Mahayana teachings, there's this idea of the bodhisattva, and sometimes that path is called the bodhisattva's path, that kind of directionality. So it's someone who has freed themselves and made a commitment to stay within the cycles of worldly rebirth until everyone is free. I'm sharing that to mostly sort of give an introduction to this idea, present something about how the sense of freedom and where it comes from, it's kind of different in these practices. Big picture, trying to tie this into the idea of what can come from emptiness practice and what emptiness practice is about, is a way of practicing that can engender a relationship of freedom with things of the world. So, is a ways of practicing to kind of change our relationship, how we conceive of the world, ourselves, other people, things we come into relationship that can afford a degree of freedom, not so much about kind of dropping the attachment and moving beyond. Yeah, it's different. It's a different kind of vibe. There is, if you're not familiar with, this emptiness practices, they're very central to Zen practice, like super central to Zen practice. Chan practice, and very kind of foundational within Vajrayana practice and things like that. So just very sketchy to say. If you're not familiar with the term emptiness used in this context, more helpful to think of it as a kind of adjective that can be applied to absolutely everything. So emptiness, it's not something you don't go there, you don't have it. Instead, it's a sort of perspective that opens through this way of practicing that you see that absolutely everything, your sense of self, the sense of phenomena in the world, whatever you can perceive through the sense doors is necessarily empty of an inherent existence. So things don't exist in a singular, fixed, unchanging way. That's the perspective you're trying to open. And certainly, this kind of perspective opens through Vipassana practice and insight meditation practice too. But it's the central focus of emptiness practice and very central to the Mahayana teachings. So you see, things don't exist one way. How they are met by a given mind, my mind, someone else's mind, is hugely central to how they appear. Yeah. And so, the practices offer this possibility to explore that and become convinced that that is true. Yeah. So things from a self-centered perspective, where kind of most of my energy is coming from evaluating, not consciously, but this is the kind of movement of clinging, evaluating, is this thing good for me? Is this thing bad for me? Part of what needs to happen there is a sense that things are there really is a good and a bad. Yeah, there's a real clarity about how experience shows up, that it's separate from me, that it's different from me, and that these two things are different. That's just part of what comes with that that whole package of clinging and getting a sense of who we are through how we relate to other things. So you can practice in ways that kind of disabuse us of that impression that things exist in this one singular way. So in a way, it's a kind of practices that can support the possibility of finding a kind of freedom in the lived experience. Yeah, there's a kind of emphasis of it, or that's my kind of take home from it. There's a quote from Shunryo Suzuki, who was a very well-known Zen teacher. And he said something like, the secret of Zen can be described in just a few words, not always so. Yeah. Like what one is trying to do is to not just open an idea or an understanding, but kind of live from a conviction that yes, it appears this way, but very deeply I know not always this way. And there's a certain kind of freedom that comes from that. I'd say many different freedoms, yeah, that can come from that. I'll just talk a little bit, what can come from that. Again, this is very sketchy. I'm just kind of laying some groundwork. You will cling less, if you sort of know, like, well, it appears this way, but I can't be 100% sure. I can't be 100% sure that things must go this way, or this person is, my judgment of them is 100%. Correct is like the clinging will naturally kind of lessen, and the suffering that comes with that will come, and the sense of the self as separate will diminish. All of that will happen. There's a kind of, and here's where now I feel like, okay, that was just like a kind of like a crummy kind of Cliff's Notes talk on emptiness, just like laying the groundwork. Now I'm tying us, I'm pulling us back into this exploration of the creative process. Believe it or not, I've gotten better at doing that. Like it used to be worse, but it's a, yeah, anyway. There is a kind of space that opens up through emptiness practice, when we see that things are not always as they appear. And I don't just know, but I have realized, kind of digested, it's become part of me, this perspective that things exist in other ways from other perspectives. Yeah. That things also are interconnected. Yeah. This idea of conditioning comes into play. Causes and conditions have made this so. Yeah. It's not just like 100% good, 100% bad of its own nature. It's things are coming together. Things can be seen from another perspective. I deeply intuit that. One of the things that comes from that is the possibility of a real intimacy with experience, a real intimacy with other people. When I'm not needing things primarily through my fixed ideas of how they are, or a demand that things be 100% good, 100% bad, no openness to the possibility that there's other perspectives there. It opens a possibility for a genuine kind of intimacy, yeah, with experience. And for me, this sort of starts to be very, this is a like a connection for me that's really important with these teachings and the art practice. Yeah, it's like I'm not just pushing forward with my agenda when I'm meeting my work and when I'm meeting what is inspiring the work or my idea of who the work is for. There's an openness, there's a receptiveness, there's possibility. Yeah, I'll read some quotes that are coming from Mahayana, from Zen teachers, I think is what I have today. Kind of hopefully sort of pointing to that, but that comes through. And that's a really lovely kind of connection. It's like we can really be in contact with the world and what inspires us and what touches us in a different way. You know, if you're in an intimate relationship with someone, or you know, if I've certainly had this in my family, you know, where I felt like, oh, this person, they have 100% like fixed ideas of who I am and what I'm capable of. That is not a relationship that really opens, or different dimensions don't really come from that, or unfolding doesn't come from that. It's just like, all right, like that's how you see me, then kind of we're done. We'll just kind of leave it. We'll leave it at that. There's nothing that can open from that. And so that sort of attitude of pinning things down, knowing what they are, and also knowing what we're really possible of, what is really possible for us creatively, we bring that kind of certainty into the mix. And that really closes down the possibility of a process that has this openness. A process that has openness has fuel and nourishment. A process that does not, it's like one at some point or another, is the spark is going to die. Yeah, there's not going to be any oxygen coming in, and it will close. We'll have another note. Yeah, Mahayana traditions, like Zen traditions, those are the traditions, like Western Zen, those are the traditions I've spent the most time kind of hanging out in and around. They really value and kind of emphasize spontaneity, you know, a kind of freshness, a lack of prejudgment. You know, that's kind of the directionality and emphasis of the teachings. I think it's part of the aesthetics, even, you know, the whole vibe is kind of emphasizing the possibility for this freshness, this idea of a skillful response. You know, that to me is a very Zen kind of idea. It's they're not so big on kind of the rules, like they're there in the Zen traditions, the kind of ethical mandates and things that are, you know, you will certainly find within the teachings of the historical Buddha, especially for the monks and nuns. There's the list of things to do and not to do. In Zen, they're really pushing towards a kind of wisdom that allows one to make a skillful response. You know, so it's a response that comes with a kind of freshness. You know, we have the wisdom we've accumulated and the experiences we've have, but our response is not dictated by that purely. Yeah, something else can kind of come in. I did put a link in the teachings to a talk by my teacher, Rob Berbea, called This Matter of Emptiness. That's pretty basic, like basic. It's not a basic talk, but it's a talk that is, it feels to me, one of the primary intentions is defining that term. So if that's a kind of, it's not an easy term to define, certainly not quickly. So if you're interested in just a little more, I don't know, clarity and precision around how that term is used, check out that talk. It's a pretty light, it's not, it's a pretty straightforward, I'll say, straightforward kind of Dharma talk. Yeah. All right. I'm going to read some quotes from Zen teachers, kind of that are coming from this emptiness perspective, but they're talking about art making and art process. Yeah. And just sort of see how those land. I like them. They're pointing to something here for me. The first is from a Zen teacher named Norman Fisher, who's a poet. I believe he's still living. All right, here's the quote. It occurs to me that the world and the self, as we usually understand them, are exactly frozen, rigid, cold, painful to the touch, icily conceptual. My personal problems, my conditioning, my attitudes, my self-definitions, what I hear from those around me, and the general conception of what the world is and where it is going. All of which is infused with an unspoken and general sense of dread. I'll kind of stop here. Like, to me, there's a connection between the sense of a lack of possibility and a certain kind of dread. Yeah, that feels to me a little, at least from my sense of what he's pointing to. Then he goes on to say, but when I switch the news off to write or read a poem or otherwise access the art experience, I thaw out. The world disappears, or at least the sense that it is impossible and intractable does. He goes on to say, this is more than mere distraction, taking my mind off of my or the world's problems. Engagement with art produces a state that is the opposite of distraction. So he's talking about this movement into engagement with art. He could also be talking about like what does it mean to come into a skillful, intimate relationship with the world in a way. You know, is one part kind of setting down the baggage, the conditioning, the narrowing, the fear, the dread, you know, that kind of comes from that limited perspective. And it's another, and that opens the possibility to engage in a very different way. Yeah. To engage in a different way. Not talking about, you know, like when we're really clinging and the self sense is really polarizing things, really heavy. The tendency is to go kind of one way or another. It's like more clinging, more suffering, more narrowing, or just like kind of bouncing off into some sort of, distraction, addiction, you know, like some sort of thing that's really not quite the point. So some avoidant behavior, I could say that might be a good way to put it. So he's talking about another possibility that can come through opening with a kind of art creativity, like all of these kinds of capacities we have can kind of shift what's possible. I'm got a couple quotes from Chogyam Trungpa, or a couple ideas from him. He was the founder of the Shambhala tradition. He's no longer alive. He was controversial in a lot of ways. I have a love-hate relationship with his dharma, but there's some things that he said about the art, the relationship of dharma practice to art that really feel quite right on to me, and that I haven't heard in other places. So I'm still kind of going to bring something from him in. I got this stuff from a book of his that was like a series of talks about creativity, art process. I think he was a photographer, among other things. All right, this is the first one. It is very tempting to spell everything out which proves one's legitimacy, one's wisdom, or one's artistry. So he's talking about in a given piece of work, it's very tempting to do that, to prove your legitimacy, wisdom, or artistry. But according to the Buddhist tradition, in communicating with the world, particularly in the realm of art, the only thing you can do is hint. Yeah, the only thing you can do is hint. Just give a basic headline. It depends on your attitude. If you want to demonstrate something very badly, you achieve that, then your work of art is a dead one. But if you present your work of art as a completely full message without spelling out every word of it, then you have given the public a corner of what you might say. Therefore, it's still fertile in people's minds, and there is room for it to unfold. It is living art. So there's something in there for me. It's like very much captures this sort of dynamic around like what comes from understanding emptiness, realizing emptiness. And how we live a life with kind of more possibility, engagement, and intimacy. He's talking specifically about the art process. I find it to be 100% true as well, or like just from my perspective. When we see a work of art where it feels like, wow, that's a great painting, or that's like a really well crafted, whatever it is, whatever craft, whatever medium, whatever form, But we have the sense of it, and usually it's not even very conscious, that the primary intention somehow was just to be like super perfect and good, to kind of the artist to kind of display one's mastery. You see it, you're impressed by it, and you move on. But there's no invitation to you as the viewer to come into the space of that work. There's no vulnerability from the artist. There's no space there. There's no, like let's have a conversation, or something like, this is what I cannot resolve about my vulnerable human existence. What about you? It's like when we see work that is actually somehow engaging that way, inviting in that way, opening that way, is very different. So again, then coming back to this relationship, when the reason for creating art is kind of primarily about proving something about oneself, the process will tend to close and be very painful for the artist, but the resultant art will also be like very closed too. Yeah, that would be the experience of it being viewed. Again, I'm speaking in generalizations. And I'll share, hopefully I'll have time to share a little bit about my process, just to say like I spent a lot of time there. And it was very painful for me, a lot of time really invested in what my art said about me. So I'm not trying to make judgment, just that's my experience, that's a way it closes down, not just for the artist, but also for those seeing the art or receiving the art in whatever way. I had a poem I think I read last time called The Wood Carver. The translation was by Thomas Merton, who himself has a lot of very interesting perspectives that I love about this kind of spiritual practice, dharma, creativity, connection. So he translated, I think, many poems by this Taoist poet, yeah, and one is called The Wood Carver, and it's very specifically about art making, and it's very clear and it's very simple, and I just think it's very right on about this relationship to kind of egoic investment in the art making process, as well as the necessity of a kind of responsiveness, kind of this kind of ability to receive as well as to give or to make. So it's a I link to it. So you can read the poem. I think it's very clear on its own if you want. It's on the resources page. Maybe the last thing to say about this these emptiness teachings, receiving emptiness teachings, playing with the approaches that come from that within the art practice in a way, and as well as within the the life, like why we practice Dharma, why we meditate. There's a certain, my sense is a certain advantage to approaching these ideas that is kind of, there's something easier for people who have a long history with making things and caring about their creative life and that art perspective. This is purely anecdotal. I do not have the research to back it up. But I have, taught emptiness practice in non-creative context quite a bit. And I've also led meditation groups purely for artists that weren't very much about like communicating Buddhist teachings. There is something that artists kind of get, again, huge generalization, about the fact that things don't have to be really real in some objective way to matter, to be of profound value. There's something that it's just like, well, of course that's true. If you look at someone who's been like a writer for decades, or a painter, or even someone who works primarily with like color form materials, whether that's textiles, collage, ceramics, it's like you have your relationship with these images, be they colors or be they fully fleshed out sense of characters, they live with you, they live within you, they matter to you, they inform you, even if no one ever knew that they were there, they have a value. And two, they help you to share something, convey something. They're your team in a way of sharing through your art. I don't know. For me, it's kind of teaching outside of the art context. This idea that things don't exist in a singularly real way can be really challenging without, or there's often a process of kind of coming to terms with what that might mean and why that might be okay. Those kinds of ideas, we all want a happy ending for ourselves. That's every human being wants happiness, safety, like all of these things. We've been told, kind of in our culture, through our conditioning, through evolutionary traits in our nervous system, whatever it is, that there's one way that we're going to find happiness. And really, our goal is to just like keep trying to like, get to the top and whatever that means, and hope that works out. And so when you start challenging that there's a like a right way to do things, it starts to poke really deeply at, kind of all of these, this very, I don't know, it just pokes very deeply at lots of stuff. You're all Dharma practitioners, so you've all probably had, places where these things have been very challenging. I certainly was like, please get me out of here at the first like emptiness Dharma talk I ever heard. It was very like, I just, I didn't have a place to hold these ideas. But with the art process, it's like you can play with different ideas and different possibilities, and there can be a very immediate feedback that is deeply reassuring that holding too tightly is not the way to go, or that something can really open that is very worthwhile. When we set down the agenda, it can just like sometimes it's just like a little idea, a little thought. I might go this way, that way, and it's just like a hole gets poked through this kind of gray world into something very vivid and alive, and it just like flows in. And it's just like, wow, I really connect these kinds of Dharma teachings and what can happen with playing very deeply with our creative process. And so for me, it's like, there can be a real resonance that happens between the two that deepens the two. My sense is that with the art process, because it can be so like dynamic and we see it, it can bring a kind of I don't know, confidence about letting go that's different, and I think really helpful and really lovely. If you have that, if you have that in your practice, it's not necessary, but yeah. All right. So that's a lot. I think I just blat out a whole lot of stuff. I think that'll be the most talking I'll do.